Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. Boy, man, what a crazy week it's been. It is Memorial Day today, and just wrapping up a long week. I blasted out to California a week ago, so Monday of last week, and I made a run out there to pick up a load of walnut, and man, did I strike gold. I've got a friend, I think I talked about it in one of the previous podcasts, but went out there, hit this orchard, had a guy with a wood miser bandsaw mill that you tow behind on a truck come and we cut up a whole bunch of logs. I have no idea how many. It was fast and furious. Man, I screwed my back up, though, the first hour that we were out there moving these 2 1/4 inch thick slabs of walnut, trying to, you know, pull them off the mill myself and manhandle them and get them over onto a stack, and tweaked my back pretty good. So I've been pretty well stoved up since Wednesday of last week, and but it didn't dampen my enthusiasm for the project. And so we cut a bunch of it, stacked and stickered it out there and sealed the ends. And then I picked up a truck, well, not even a truckload, it's actually a trailer load. So I brought out my llama trailer. It's a 2-horse trailer. I think it's about, probably interior, it's probably 10 feet to where it starts to slant towards the nose of the trailer. And I've got that thing filled end to end and 3 feet deep, no kidding, in walnut. I mean, more walnut than I'll use in a lifetime. And that is zero of the walnut that I spent, you know, last week milling out there. So I now have a mountain of Claro walnut, burl, curly Claro walnut, and I got 60 English walnut gunstock blanks that had, you know, some minor checking or other defect that kicked it out of the rifle pile there. So each one of those risers, or rather each one of those gunstock blanks, I can, you know, depending on how the grade of the wood is, you know, if the pattern or the figure and the grain and stuff continues throughout the whole stock, I can get at least a couple bows out of each stock. And not so much if the, you know, the grain doesn't carry through on the stock, but I've got a lot. And that, you know, those gunstock blanks have been drying for some, you know, 10 plus years. So they're ready to rock. So I'm pretty excited. I haven't even unloaded it yet. I've been organizing in my shop and doing a little bit of hanging out with the family and working on the office. I stopped by my taxidermist on the way back through Reno and picked up most of my mule deer that he had. I just ran out of wall space. I realized that, you know, I called him up. I was like, dude, I'm not gonna be able to do any more shoulder mounts. I don't even have enough room if I just hang the skulls up. So if you go to my Instagram page, I did a little video of the office now, which my wife walked in. She's like, oh my goodness, looks like a graveyard in here, because there's a bunch of Euro mounts and some of the skull cap mounts. But it's pretty neat to see them all in one place. And there's a lot of deer that I'd forgotten that I had taken. And instead of hanging his rafters, to actually have them here in the office now, I'm pretty tickled to be able to look at them all, and it brings back so many memories, man. It's so cool. And I now have a much better appreciation for why people build trophy rooms. This is not a big office. It's probably 20 feet by maybe 24 feet roughly. And there's a lot of, you know, cabinets and stuff in here for my work. But I literally have pretty much every available square foot of wall space covered in mounts, if it's or antlers, if it doesn't, if they're tall enough. So above some of the doors, the ceiling drops down, so there's not quite enough room. But yeah, pretty happy. So it was busy over the weekend. I was working on that, and I can't wait to dig into that pile of walnut and get a good look at what I've got here. So the next few weeks are going to be fun as I get to burrow into that pile. So this week we have another Mike Mitten chapter, One with the Wilderness, and this is the last week that you're going to be able to take advantage of Mike's offer that he's got. So log on to his website, Herd Bull Productions, and pick up a copy of, I can't even remember what the offer is now, but you guys, I'm sure, have heard it enough there that you'll remember. So again, this is the last week to get into that drawing. And I haven't checked, but he did say that he got this book here, One with the Wilderness, and I believe it's in paperback now, available on the website. So pick yourself up a copy of that while you're at it, and be sure to get his moose hunting, that's what it was, the moose hunting DVD, and you get a copy of the condensed version of Primal Dreams, which can't recommend enough, and that puts you in the drawing for the autographed copy of the book. So right now we are on to chapter 4, Do-It-Yourself Hunt in Alaska, which, man, I'll tell you, I've done that before several times actually, and what a blast. You know, if you are able to make it up at some point in time, can't recommend it enough. Alaska is expensive, but you can certainly cut down on the cost by doing it a DIY and, you know, plan it, you know, a couple of years out, so you have plenty of time to do the research. And whether you do a caribou hunt, you know, which is probably the most realistic, either a caribou or a Sitka blacktail, one of the two, especially if you do a Sitka blacktail in August, then you're hunting them up there in the alpine, and you're away from the bears on the streams there, and it's probably the most cost effective or cost efficient, you know, trip that you could do up there. Although, I mean, they are Sitka blacktail, so it's a different subspecies of deer, but you know, they're not as exotic as moose or caribou. And but you know, a caribou hunt, you know, while you still can, while they're still, you know, some of the herd numbers are still in decent enough shape to hunt. I still haven't shot a caribou myself, so that's maybe I'll have to make that a priority here myself one of these days. Any case, chapter 4, Do-It-Yourself Hunt in Alaska. Hunting in Alaska is a dream of many bow hunters. The remoteness of Alaska often forces residents and non-residents alike to depend on others for transportation in and out of game-rich areas. Non-guided drop camp hunting gives you the pride of accomplishing the hunt yourself while employing an air charter service for transportation. After a full year of planning our hunt, my three hunting partners, John Schneider, James Lane, and Mark Hewkin, and I arrived in caribou camp on August 28th. We pitched our tents as our Flyers beaver plane took off from the 400-yard-long lakeshore that would be our home for the next 7 days. The area had plenty of hills and washes, but as we surveyed the terrain, we realized that the tundra itself offered little concealment from caribou eyes. The bases of some of the hills were covered with a thick growth of tag alders, which could help. The next day, we paired up in groups of two. Mark Hewkin and I struck out in search of Mulchatna River caribou. We climbed hills to get better views and walked over and around them for miles. We glassed for hours, but out of the hundreds of caribou we saw, none were shootable bulls. The caribou were traveling in small groups, a dozen animals being the most. At the end of the day, we met John and James back at camp. They went in different directions, but had the same results, slightly sighting mostly cows and calves. The following day saw more miles of walking, but no bulls. We did, however, come across multiple red fox. They would let us walk right up to them within 10 yards before disappearing into their burrows. At 7 o'clock in the evening, Mark felt 12 hours was enough and decided to head back to camp a mile away. I was tired, but couldn't resist climbing one more hill before I called it a day. As I reached the top, it started to rain. Looking back, I could see Mark in the distance working his way back to camp, dry. From the other side of the hill, I detected movement. I quickly hid behind a small clump of alders while watching a group of caribou, four cows and two bulls with small velvet-covered racks. 10 yards of tundra separated us, but the nomads continued on, unaware of the weary but frustrated hunter in the alders. I waited for 15 minutes before I slipped out to take a peek down the hillside. Down the flats, I could see four more caribou. Using my binoculars, they proved to be cows and calves. As I glassed the near shore of a small pond at the base of my hill, I was elated to discover a mature bull rubbing his antlers on willow saplings. The setting sun at my back reflected light off the bull, still in velvet and displaying a brilliant white neck mane. Its rack had small double shovels, slight palmation of one of the beam ends, and fairly long bez tines. It was not the giant caribou I dreamed of taking, but it was the nicest bull I had seen the past 3 days. I plotted a course down the hill that would close the 300-yard distance between the bull and me. While moving along a finger of alders, the bull helped my cause by walking along the shore towards me. It seemed to be annoyed by the many flies buzzing about his head. After gaining another 50 yards of real estate on the bull, I could barely contain my excitement as I watched the noble prey bed down in the sand along the pond's bank. The dry summer in this area of Alaska had just experienced left a sandy track along this evaporating pool. Judging from the position of the bull, the shape of the pond, the quietness of the clean sand, the softness of the drizzling rain, and the direction of the breeze, I was provided ultimate stalking conditions. I cautiously moved closer. I didn't know the bull's exact position since I had lost sight of his antler tips when I stepped down onto the beach. After sneaking along 70 yards, I caught the fairly musk smell of the bull as the wind blew towards me. Confidently, I peered around some willow limbs to get a better look at the animal. He was bedded 30 yards away. I closed the gap another 10 yards before deciding this was it. I drew my 75-pound Brackenberry recurve while rising above the willows. The bull was staring directly at me. Upon release, the arrow struck home and the caribou immediately bolted straight away, only to stop and look back from 40 yards. My second arrow struck the bull in the flank, cutting the femoral artery and puncturing the liver as well as one lung. He trotted off another 40 yards, slowed to a walk, and collapsed and died. I was one happy camper. I gutted the caribou and propped him to cool as twilight overcame me. Mark and I went back the next day to retrieve the meat, horns, and cape. I could hardly believe my eyes upon arriving at the kill site. The only visible evidence of the bull was the gut pile. The entire caribou was gone. We walked over a knoll to find a bear had mangled the remains of my kill. It looked like a truck had hit it. The carcass was moved more than 50 yards and both shoulders were removed. The grizzly ate some of the meat and pulled a portion of the hide from the bull. While Mark stood guard with the 44 Magnum revolver, I trimmed off all the meat I could. Even though it was late and I had full intentions of packing the meat out the following morning, my action of only gutting him was not justified. When I returned to the animal, I realized the lack of respect I must have shown for this beautiful creature. Being tired was no excuse. I wasn't too tired to shoot it. The law doesn't require you to get the antlers, but it does mandate that you recover all the meat. I realized I could not have carried all the meat out at once, but I should have boned it out and removed it at least some distance from the carcass that night. I do respect these animals. I know the antlers and cape are important to us, but the meat is also important to scavenging bears and wolves. The next day, Mark shot a nice caribou, and John and James both saw good bulls. One bull in particular was tremendous. It was with a band of 40 caribou, but the closest it came to them was 80 yards, too far for a competent shot. John watched the bull for more than half an hour and judged its score well over 400 inches. it was one of the highlights of the trip for them. Morale was high the following day, but it ended with no shootable bulls being sighted. Sunday concluded our group's hunt for caribou, and the plane came to move us to moose camp. As we flew northeast, we could see the tundra slowly giving way to a predominance of spruce and tag alder swamps. The scenery was magnificent, with the landscape spiced with a pinch of animal life in the form of caribou and an occasional moose. The four of us were planning an 11-day moose hunt from our second campsite on a large lake at the base of the Aleutian mountain range. Everywhere we looked, there was sphagnum moss and soft, wet ground. We cut spruce boughs and layered them on the ground to serve as the base under the plastic ground cloth and tent floor to prevent water from soaking through. Looking uphill from the lake, we observed a near-perfect line where the coniferous forest stopped and the alders and willows started. These thickets covered the next half mile or so until they surrendered to a barren tundra on top. Moose would feed heavily on the willows. It was our objective to climb the 2.5-mile slope, which ascended 2,000 feet, to glass for moose near the top. Every morning we had this 1.5-hour climb. Once we reached the top, the day was spent glassing and moving slowly along the ridge, looking for bulls that might present themselves below. The temperature on top seemed cooler than at camp. If we got wet from rain, damp vegetation, or sweat during the climb, we found it tough to stand the winds above the timberline, perfect hypothermic conditions. After 2 days, neither groups located any respectable bulls along this 5-mile ridge. We had to expand our range by crossing a gorge and hunting the other side. Leaving at 7 a.m., I climbed the slope, descended the 1,000-foot gorge, crossed a fast-moving glacier stream, and scaled the far side of the gorge. I traveled 2 miles along the ridgetop with a steep washout below me before reaching huntable terrain before noon. This new slope was similar, except the spruce weren't as thick, the grade wasn't as steep, and the willows and alders marbled the area, leaving large accessible holes in the cover. This was just what a bow hunter would order. Like the previous 2 days, I would look over the area with binoculars for half an hour at a time, then move 100 or 200 yards to change the slight angle and expose fresh terrain. From 11:30 a.m. until 3 p.m., I hunted this side, seeing 9 different moose from my vantage point. They were seen either in the low willow swamps, crossing open ridges in the spruce forest, or feeding in and around beaver ponds, but none were bulls. I also enjoyed watching a large brown bear sow and her 3 cubs feeding on blueberries. Since we were within 200 miles of the coast and salmon spawned in the lake, both subspecies, grizzlies as well as brown bear, inhabit this region. While admiring the family of bears, I noticed something white moving in an alder thicket 600 yards below me. With the aid of binoculars, I determined it was the light-colored palm of a bull's antlers. There were 2 bulls in that thicket. Both were visible for 30 seconds, then they moved until the vegetation swallowed them up. I put my pack on, got my bearings on the thicket from above, glanced over at the bears, and started down off the perch. As I walked down the slope, the land directly below me exposed itself, and 200 yards away were 3 more grizzlies. Turning and walking along the ridge, I crossed a washout before descending to avoid the bears. The exact location of the bulls wasn't always apparent on the step-like grade. After 20 minutes, I arrived on a knoll with my alder destination just 150 yards below me. I waited here for a few minutes to see if the bull had moved out of the cover. Shaking of alders and crashing of rubbing antlers was evidence of their presence. I moved quickly to a ditch of running water that snaked through the willows and entered the alder area where the moose were. This made it easier to walk, and the constant babbling of the water covered any noise I might make. I got to within 100 yards when I saw the huge bull break out of the alders to enter the low willow swamp I was in. The willows were mature, but years of browsing moose made them look like a gardener had pruned them to 3 feet. The bull was large, and his dark brown body did not display the light-colored phase around the shoulders like some of the cows I have seen. He moved his head back and forth near the ground, raking his antlers through the willows. His palms were light on top and darker underneath. He had at least 4 points to his brow tines on each side and a lot of other tines outlining the outside perimeter of each palm. I judged the outside spread to be a little over 60 inches. He walked broadside to me, but when he stopped to abuse more willows, I moved closer. He was 60 yards away as I continued to advance. The bull was almost across the willow opening, and I thought maybe I should take the 40-yard shot before he went back into the alders. Luck was on my side because he turned around and lowered his shoulders and forelegs to the ground. The tremendous weight of his rear was soon to follow as I watched him bed. I did not have any time to make a plan or absorb the feeling of being this close to the noble beast when the wind suddenly blew over my shoulder towards the bull. The bull quickly stood and looked in my direction. He pivoted and made a perfect escape in the alders. His flight alarmed the second bull, which followed the first down into the spruce. On the way back to camp, I saw another grizzly, bringing the day's total to 8. I knew this was a good area because of seeing 11 moose, one a respectable bull. The next day, Mark and I left camp while it was still dark in an attempt to get more hunting time. We went up the mountain and across the gorge, but the morning fog never lifted. We stayed up there for hours before we decided it might be better to go back to camp and try again the following day. To find moose, we needed to get above them, and that would put us in the fog. The wind picked up a little in the evening to clear the sky. Frost greeted us at dawn, and Mark and I felt good about starting our trek up toward the gorge. I showed Mark where not to cross the stream by falling into the rushing water. I was shocked by the icy temperature and learned that in Alaska, it's not the size of the man that counts, it's the height of his hip boots. Mark laughed as he described how the velocity of the water was so great that a stream of it deflected off my backpack and launched an arc over my head without wetting my hat. Dry wool clothes wrapped in plastic in my day pack salvaged the day for me. It was not long before we spotted a cow. 40 minutes later, we saw a bull cruising along a spruce line at a distance of about a mile. Mark jumped around, and I could tell he wanted to go after it. I explained to him that we'd have to be patient and watch what the animal did. I wouldn't suggest leaving the mountainside until we located a bull with a cow in heat, one feeding in a stationary location like a beaver pond, or one bedded down. We took turns watching this bull while the other guy glassed for others. Although he looked impressive, he didn't stop anywhere in sight, so we had to assume he went on. We spotted another bull, watched him for 15 minutes, and decided we would try to get him. Because of the position of the bull and a number of cows, I would try the final stalk alone. From 75 yards away, we could see at least 3 cows, 1 calf, and 1 small bull with the big one. The large bull would make a scrape near the spruce, chase one of the cows, and then come back to scrape angrier than ever. Small spruce trees were no match for his rage. Some sort of vocalization accompanied every action he made. He grunted a lot and made a deep, almost sneezing sound. He kept charging in and out of the spruce and willows, so we watched him for about 20 minutes before I could make a move. I saw my chance as the big bull gave chase to the little bull after he came too close to the scrape. Just before I left his side, Mark reminded me to be careful when I got close to the bull and not go after him right away if I got an arrow into him. Finding my way through the thicket wasn't my only worry. I still had to contend with the cows as well as the small bull. I saw the young bull cut to my left, and I knew I was between him and his aggressor. I wasn't sure where my bull was until I heard him unleash his wrath on another large tag alder tree. I held my breath as the bull walked along the outside of the thicket I was in. He was grunting with every step. As I freed myself from the low willows, I looked for the moose. He was standing broadside at 35 yards. I drew and shot. My arrow hit the bull in the shoulder. Upon impact, the bull jumped about 10 yards. As he slowly swung his head to look at me, the huge palms threatened to deflect my second arrow. My release was in time as the 730-grain 2419 aluminum arrow passed under his antlers to bury up to the fletching just 3 inches behind the first arrow. The bull could make only 50 yards before his incredible strength was drained and he fell in the willows. After a quick celebration, we examined this exceptional animal. The body was immense. His antlers were 58 inches wide, and I counted 29 points. Although the palms were a little lopsided, they supported long tines. It had four nice brow tines on one side and five on the other. I could not believe my quest for a moose was over. We went to work on boning out the meat and placing game bags in nearby trees. The bull went down 11 hard miles from camp, so instead of moving the moose, we moved the camp. This left me with a 2-mile pack job to a new lake. We left a note for our pilot explaining where and why we had moved. With a caribou and a moose under my belt, packing the meat out to the lake was a labor of love. Well, almost. Packing meat is not one of my favorite activities, but it's an essential part of a successful hunt. During the rest of our trip, our group saw several more moose, some of the bulls over 60 inches, but they avoided being arrowed. We drew to the campfire of our last evening and told stories of our respective encounters during the trip. I sat in the warmth of the fire and turned the flesh around the ears, eyes, nose, and lips of my bull's cape and readied it for salt curing once we returned to town. Altogether, we saw more than 80 moose, thousands of caribou, 36 grizzlies, and 4 black bears. Our discussions also turned to our families and loved ones we were all beginning to miss. During the 3-week trip, we each lost between 15 and 25 pounds, so disclosing what the first things we planned to eat upon civilization was quite rewarding. At midnight, we were all awakened to the sound of a heavy wind. The wind continued all day and into the following day. Our pilot, who did not know we had moved our camp to this more secluded lake, could not land the float plane on the big lake due to 3-foot swells and was now 2 days overdue. I have never seen winds of this 40 to 80 miles per hour velocity stay active for so long. We built a huge anticipation to go home and ate up all of our respective rations. The only food we had was moose meat and wild blueberries that the land had provided us. Mark stood up at 4 p.m. and started collecting his gear. After grabbing his bow and arrows, he proclaimed, "I can't take this sitting around any longer. The pilot told us if the weather got bad and he couldn't come on time for us to keep on hunting. So that's exactly what I'm going to do." The three of us watched as Mark headed off in the direction of a tall hill about a mile and a half south of camp. I said, You know he's going up to see if he can find that big bull that got away from him a few days ago." John and James laughed in agreement. The drive to succeed was high in all of us, and we understood why he left. About 4 hours later, we heard a faint sound that overpowered the wind. "What is that?" John asked. James replied, "It sounds like Mark yelling for help," I agreed. "It sounds like he's saying he got mauled." James and I grabbed our packs and started out to meet him, and what we found will be the focus of the next chapter. To be continued. Oh, that's not very nice, Mike, leaving us with a cliffhanger. Well, guys, I appreciate you tuning in for another episode, and we will catch this. I apologize for the lack of congruency over the last several episodes. It's been a little hectic, and I keep forgetting to record episodes to get them to Jake to post, and so we're having to post episodes that we, you know, had pre-recorded. And actually, that last one with Pat Tidings from Australia was one that we had recorded a couple of years ago, and I had misplaced it, and I came across it when I was rooting through looking for some files the other day. So hopefully you got a chance to listen to that one. It's still relevant information there. Again, I appreciate you guys tuning in and look forward to talking to you again.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support.
I come down for-